Call to order for the State Government Finance Committee. Representative Runbeck, will you move the minutes for March 3rd?
Move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Runbeck moves the minutes for March 3rd, 2015. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for March 3rd, 2015 are approved. Members that are just arriving, we have with us today the Department Administration that's going to give us an overview of how contracts on the state level are handled. And we have Mr. Allen and Ms. Hayes that are here today. Mr. Allen just gave a description of slide 2 that's in your packet. And with that, Mr. Allen, if you wish to proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you so much. If you look at slide 3, you'll see on a basic level how the state's central procurement office operates and what we have authority for. We have direct authority to purchase goods, services, and building construction. And then we have indirect oversight authority as it relates to the state's technical, professional technical contracts. Those are essentially the intellectual services that the state contracts for. We also have authority to do enterprise professional technical service contracts, and we have some of those in the areas of IT services. We do those in consultation with the Minute Office. We have enterprise professional technical contracts for data analytics, arbitrators, mediators, court reporters, and others.
Mr. Allen, on that IT portion, can you give me a little description of how that's changed since we've gone to centralizing all of our IT functions with Minute?
You know, I can, although I think my colleague Betsy Hayes would do an even better job of that than I would because she manages two of our enterprise IT contracts.
Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair, the consolidation that occurred has changed the way that we do contracting for IT services, primarily in the sense that the agencies, instead of drafting some of the statements of work and RFPs in a siloed fashion, are sending them into what they call Minute Central, that has a team of people that work directly on with the agencies to prepare the procurement documents. And so that centralized team within Minute is shepherding the contracts and the RFPs and things like that through the process. So it's assisted in ways where instead of working with the individual agencies and the many, many people, we're focused on working primarily with a smaller group of folks, which has helped with consistency and consistency with the documents. So that's the primary difference, I think, with the consolidation.
And are there any entities? I know there's some folks that have exemptions to going through you guys. Who would that be? Who does that all entail?
Madam Chair, that's actually a fairly major part of our presentation coming for. If you can wait for that, we'll get you substantial detail on that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Going back to slide 3, you'll see that the Central Procurement Office also operates some cooperative purchasing programs. These are particularly significant for state and local governments because these allow local units of government in Minnesota to use the contracts that the Central Procurement Office and Administration creates. As part of our cooperative purchasing initiatives, we also manage two of the three largest multi-state cooperatives in the country. And one of those is for the purchase of pharmaceuticals, another is for the purchase of computers. And those contracts that are managed by the state of Minnesota are used by almost all 50 states in the country. We also have responsibilities for what we call vendor management, and that includes assuring that state vendors are performing adequately, and we have some authorities for suspending and debarring vendors who may not be fulfilling their contractual obligations. So looking at slide 4, you'll get a sense of what the state buys, how much money we spend. Thanks in part to MMB's new open, Madam Chair, I'm seeing a question, I believe.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question back on slide 3, on item 3, when you said the working with the local governments. When you guys have a baseline contract, is the local government compelled then to use the contract you have, or they can they opt in or opt out at their own choosing?
Mr. Hayes. Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, local units have the option of using our contracts. It's always their choice. And actually, it's a very good opportunity for them. They can shop around, essentially, and determine whether the state contract offers them the best value.
Mr. Allen.
Thank you. Because
Mr. Allen, can I pause you a second?
Of course.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, quick question with regard to the cooperative purchasing and computers, the state of Minnesota servicing, sounds like 50 states. Wondering if service contracts on that technology is also a part of the purchasing menu.
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, the 50 state contract that we have is with the manufacturers, and it's really solely for the equipment. It's not for the service component, and that presumably is more frequently done at the at the local level with local service providers.
Representative Hugh.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Allen.
Because we now have online data through the material through the MMB's open checkbook transparency site, we have probably better information than we've historically had about what the state's spending. And if you look at slide four, you'll see that we're spending roughly in the area of $3 billion a year. And the slide also shows you the top spend categories for what the state's buying. You probably won't be too surprised by anything you see on this top 10 list. Most of it is fairly self-explanatory. Number one is roads and bridges, almost $600 million. Number two is the intellectual services that I had mentioned earlier. And we've broken these out into non-information technology intellectual services at number two, and IT professional technical services at number seven. I'm not going to mention all these, but somewhere the definition may not be crystal clear. Supplies are what we normally think of things that are consumed and replaced. So it's everything from paper and pens to cleaning supplies. And actually, PCs get turned around quickly enough these days, so those are usually listed as supplies as well. Equipment is number five, is the stuff that lasts longer than supplies. So you're talking here about furniture and other IT hardware and so forth. Computer systems and services include software, maintenance, licenses. And then communications is kind of a mix of things, including freight and delivery charges, postage costs, cell phone service costs, and so forth.
And Mr. Allen, we have some questions here. And Representative Nash, are you going to introduce your guest today?
By all means. Madam Chair and members, I wanted to introduce my daughter, Hannah. She has joined me here today at the Capitol to shadow her dad and keep him out of trouble as best she can. Say
hi. Welcome, Hannah. Do you want to say hi? Come up to the microphone for a second. This is what parents do. They thoroughly embarrass you.
Say hello.
Hi.
Well, welcome to the Capitol. I hope you enjoy your stay today. We'll all have good stories for you about your dad. So.
Yeah.
Representative Nash, you have some questions?
So, Madam Chair, thank you. And for either Mr. Allen or Ms. Hayes, question regarding your list on IT-specific things. You've talked a lot about different technologies, I believe, now in three spots. Can you kind of detail for us a couple things? One, those areas, again, with maybe a little greater detail on technology spends and what you deem to be IT technology or other technology. And then I see in your IT professional and technical services, you've got $109 million. Can you break that out when you get, or can you just break that out for us and tell us where that is and what you're spending at minute? And have you done a comparison to outside costing versus the internal costing, particularly in light of the OLA report on minute services?
And Mr. Allen, is that for you or Ms. Hayes, do you think?
Well, it was complicated enough. I'd like to say it's for Ms. Hayes.
Ms. Hayes, you're on the hot seat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go right to the question I think that I can answer with some detail, which is the breakdown of the IT professional technical services, which is the area that I focus in. A lot of that spend relates to services that we acquire through a couple of major master contract programs. These are master contract programs that cover a large variety of services from analysts and project managers. It's largely staff augmentation and some project work, implementation services. So you're talking about oftentimes the services that accompany the large systems projects, whether it be the implementation services or the with configurations and customizations and that kind of thing. So I believe that is the breakdown of the IT professional services piece in number 7. With respect to what specifically is covered in the other areas, I think I can't add much to what Mr. Allen categorized with respect to hardware and software, routers, switches, servers, those types of things that you typically would consider hardware and equipment, IT equipment purchases. But we could try to see what we could do, especially with the new system, to get you a better breakdown.
That'd be great, Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. I believe Mr. Allen was going to try to chime in there to assist a little bit, but I would appreciate if we could, and I'm sure the committee would as well, if you could provide a detailed breakdown of all technology or IT spends that you have in the various buckets that you've got listed here.
Mr. Allen?
And yes, thanks in large part to this new open checkbook information. We can drill down into any of these and determine which agencies the spend is from and get some additional detail on the specifics of the spend. So we'll be happy to do that for you.
Okay. Representative Nash.
And Madam Chair, last follow-up. Have you done that comparison with Minute? That was the one part of the question I don't believe I heard. Did you do the comparison of your chargebacks and the outside world prevailing rate to make sure that you were not being part of the overcharge by Minute?
Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, we have looked at the hourly rates. I don't believe we've done a formal study or comparison, but I know that the folks at Minute, especially with respect to the hourly rates that are charged through the master contract programs, are thought to be extremely good hourly rates. But other than that, I'm not aware of a formal study or comparison that's been done.
Okay. Mr. Allen?
But Representative Nash, are you referring to the OLA audit a minute that said that they overcharged some state agencies and not others, that their rates were?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, within our procurement organization, we have not studied that OLA report to see how that impacted us.
Okay. Representative. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've got a question on three different areas, but the first one, when we look at number 1, the roads and bridges, and we see the amount there, is that both in the all funds, even with the payback for bonds, or exactly how does that, what pots of money did that come out of to make that one big number there?
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that's all pots of okay. State money. Again, we can drill down to any of these that you have more interest in. And actually, through the wonders of this open checkbook, any of us here can get at some of this information. As you develop interest in state spending in any area or what agencies are spending on what, that's a great tool and resource for any of us to get to information that simply hadn't been available up in an easy, accessible format up until a couple months ago.
Members, we'll post a link to our state government finance website because it is fun to actually go through that. I know that's kind of geeky, but it is interesting to go through. Do you know, just to piggy, I'll come back to you, Representative Howe, but does the roads and bridges, does that include transit too? Do you know?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that it would.
Okay. Representative Howe.
Thank you. And then on number 4, the rents and utilities, is that can't be the rents that we pay, that agencies pay for the buildings here. That's, I would have to believe, the rents that like the state agency in St. Cloud pays for the Midtown Mall and stuff like that, or is it a combination of all of that?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, when we pulled this information from the MMB data source, we pulled out the state-to-state payments. So this presumably would just be the rents and utilities paid to non-state entities.
Representative Howe.
Thank you. And then the last one I have is the number 8 on the building construction. How much is that? I would take that that's building construction for salt sheds and everything for Midnot 2, and does how much of that comes from like the Senate office building?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chairman, Representative, with all of this data, the quality of the data depends on what individual accounting staff in agencies are entering into the state's accounting and procurement system. So that's kind of a qualifier as to the reliability of any of this, but it is the best data we have. And in theory, this would, again, it's looking at one fiscal year, FY14, and covers everything from salt sheds to capital restoration and the new state office building. I can't tell you precisely how much of this is the new state office building, but that's certainly something we can get you if you want that.
Representative Howe.
Thank you. I think that would be great, but you're telling me that I should be able to drill down and just exactly see what comes from where to make up that number, though, correct?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's the theory, and if you put it to the test and you're not getting what you're looking for, ask us again and we'll see what we can do for you.
Great. And Mr. Allen, you said it depends upon the agencies themselves inputting the data. What kind of checks do you guys have to make sure that that's happening on a timely basis?
Madam Chair, a lot of this is the quality of the data is predicated on an assumption that state employees are entering appropriate data in appropriate categories at the right time. And I can't say that we in our agency monitor or control that in any way. I mean, to the extent that there's any kind of control, that would be coming through MMB as part of the process of routine day-to-day transactions.
Do we have anybody from MMB here today?
I don't think the risk is that it's not, the data isn't going to be entered. I think the risk is putting the data in the right accounting codes and so forth can be a challenge. And it's sometimes a bit subjective as to how things get classified. And if people aren't classifying with total consistency, it can throw off the absolute accuracy of some of what we can get out of the system.
And Mr. Allen, have you given kind of like guidelines of how to try and mitigate the confusion of where to categorize everything? Have you given guidelines to each agency so they have a better idea of how to code it?
Madam Chair, there is training for state staff that use the SWIFT system, and that's done primarily, again, through the Minnesota Management and Budget. And assuming that training is effective, that would mitigate any misclassification. But again, you're dealing with human beings who are sometimes trying to do things quickly and having to make judgment calls about where what kind of codes to use.
Okay. All right. We have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, could you give me a little more context when I look at the top spending categories in fiscal year 14? Are those a stable list of rankings, or do we see a lot of variability from year to year? Is that going to be looking different over the next couple of years? And did it look different 4 or 5 years ago? Can you give me some sense of what the context is of these ranks?
Mr. Allen.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I think the list would be fairly stable over time. In some of the big expenditure items, we have seen significant changes from one year to another, and roads and bridges is a good example. I'm thinking one of the, I'm recalling that one of the reasons that we spent considerably more money in FY13 than in FY14 is that the money spent on roads and bridges just happened to be considerably more in 13. And it just depends on what projects are happening at what point in time. And those involve so much money that that can have a pretty significant impact. But here, not enough to bring roads and bridges out of the top spot, even though it would have been maybe a quarter of a billion dollars more the previous year.
Representative Johnson? Okay. Representative Detmer?
My question was answered. Thank you.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clarify for me in terms of when this new module came online, in terms of the availability to access the data that was inputted to it.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, it was implemented publicly in January of this year. It had been in the works for a while, and there'd been some sort of test availability prior to that, but all components of it went live to the public in January.
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Allen, prior to that, was there a collection module for the data inputted, or is this our first foray into data management from this perspective?
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, before the implementation of SWIFT, there had been a similar website based on the old MAPS accounting and procurement system that was publicly available. And one of the challenges of SWIFT was getting something comparable up and running for the public. And that happened for the first time since SWIFT went live this year.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Allen, did you migrate the data over from the old system to the new system?
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, no. The current open checkbook site only has data from the SWIFT era.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Final question. You mentioned also the variability with regard to the input from the various agencies. In light of that, how can you, and this is not a question of punitive nature, but how can we rely upon the integrity of the data if we don't have consistency of the input?
Mr. Allen?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative, that's the same struggle that one would have with any data source. And what's the cliche, bad data in, bad input, bad data? Somebody help me.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Of course. I'm not implying I think this is garbage in, but again, you have literally thousands of individuals making independent, somewhat subjective judgments, and a lot of what we do in state government relies on an assumption that most of those people are competent and well-intended, and that more often than not they're making sound judgments. But there is a risk that it's more than a risk. We know that there won't be absolute consistency. Okay. But it's the best data we have, and I don't think we're getting garbage in, and so I'm confident we're not getting garbage out, but I also don't want to say that's perfect.
Representative Albright.
Well, just then, whose responsibility would that fall under in terms of for the training and for the kind of raising the bar for consistency? That would that fall under your dominion, or whose agency would that, would it be MMBT?
It's really MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget, that does the training of individuals that are using the SWIFT system.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Allen, I guess the quick question I have, it's interesting, the number two item is professional and technical services. And can we get a breakout of what those are and what contracts that involves? I mean, when you can add that with the IT, it's almost the top, would almost be the top amount of money we spend as a state.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, we can, and actually Betsy may want to comment on this because we actually produce an annual report on all state professional technical contracts, and it gives you data by agency and so forth.
Ms. Hayes?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, we do provide an annual report every September to the legislature that lists all of the contracts. We divide it by agency. We have also an alphabetical list of contractors that we use, the amounts. There's a short description of what the professional service was for, and we provide statistics as well about how many were single source contracts, for example. So all that information is delivered to the legislature each September.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's just, I'd be curious to get that report. I don't know if I've seen it before, but, you know, when you contract stuff out, I know there are things that it makes sense to contract out and things that other things it may not when you're working with agency, you know, with the state and our agencies as large as they are. But, you know, when you contract things out, the company you're doing is putting profit on top of that. And so if you have similar employees that can do that work without the profit on it, whatever their profit margin is, that's money that the state wouldn't be having to spend. But that's, I'm curious to see that report.
Okay. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, I was on item 10. You've got the $20 million for printing and advertising. Could you articulate for us the nature of the advertising that's doing?
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, I really don't have more detail on the printing versus the advertising component of this, but I can try to get that for you.
Representative Lunan.
But do you know what we're advertising or what areas are doing the advertising? Do you have that?
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, I really don't without drilling down into this category.
Okay. No, thank you. Excellent question.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Allen? Ms. Hayes?
Ms. Hayes,
yeah,
had one.
Madam Chair and Representative Lunan, I think Explore Minnesota would be one example, I believe, of an agency that expends money in that area. There is a law, I can't recall the citation, but there is a limitation on publicity representatives that state agencies are allowed to do, but there's some exceptions for certain agencies that can have publicity representatives or spend money in those areas, and Explore Minnesota is one of them.
Don't we have a cap on advertising expenditures at all, or I can't remember if that's the case. We'll have to look at maybe Mr. Shepherd, do you know if there's a cap on advertising at all?
Madam Chair, members, as Ms. Hayes said, there's definitely a limit on publicity, sort of a qualitative limit on publicity representatives and agencies, but not, I don't know of a quantitative cap.
Okay. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The on the advertising, do you know, I know there was a push at the end here for the MNsure enrollment. Would that be coming out of this budget then?
Ms.
That advertising?
I don't know for sure.
Madam Chair, Representative, I am not sure of that, and we will find that out for you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mr. Allen. Oh, okay. We've got Representative Nash and then Lane, and then we're going to proceed with the rest of the presentation. So, Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. You said a little bit ago, Mr. Allen, that you don't do an internal audit of costing, say, from Minute versus the outside world. And we've seen a couple of reports, and we've had testimony here that we've been told that outside entities are actually providing services at a lower rate than internal state-owned agencies. Do you do an audit to compare internal costing versus outside prevailing rates? Because, you know, I think that we'd want to make sure that we're not spending the taxpayers' money over and above what could be found on the in the private sector, and you know we've actually heard examples here in committee, and I'm just wondering if you take the time to do that.
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't, and one reason we don't is that there is a state law that's specifically says we can't contract out for services if there are current state employees that are able and available to provide those services now.
Madam Chair, follow up on that.
Nash.
Madam Chair, thank you. I guess I'm confused because we were told by Mr. Goldsmith that the Campaign Finance Board actually contracted with an outside group to provide IT services for them, and yet we have Minute. So am I confused in that particular area? Is that incongruous with what's going on with that law that you just mentioned, or how did we arrive at that?
Mr. Allen, or I think how it works is there are certain functions that Minute provides versus what Campaign Finance Board can contract outside of that, but I'm not sure, and that's maybe I don't know if you guys have feedback on that at all. If not, that's probably a better question for Minute in particular. Ms. Hayes, do you have any comments to that? Or
Madam Chair and Representative, I mean, I think I can add that with respect to any contract that a state agency enters into for those types of professional services, they have to, at the beginning, certify that there aren't state employees able and available, and that's an activity that's done contract by contract. So in that instance, if the Campaign Finance Board were looking to do some outside work, they would have needed to certify that Minute wasn't able, and it might be that they don't have the capacity or that's an area that they don't do, but that would have been a requirement for that board to check on before they contracted out for those services based on our statutes.
Okay. Representative Nash.
And Madam Chair, I see Mr. Shepard furiously flipping through a book. I was wondering if he might be able to quote this statute that we were just told about.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and members, there's actually two statutes that relate to service contracts. One relates, as Ms. Hayes said, to professional and technical services. That's 16C.08 subdivision 2 clause 1. And there's another provision that relates to general service contracts, services that aren't for professional and technical services, and that is 16C.09 paragraph A clause 1.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just one last follow-up.
Representative Nash.
Is it safe to say then that we're not doing an audit of internal costing, even though we have a state employee that might do it, that may be over and above what we could get on in the private sector? Is that a safe statement?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be true. It is a safe statement.
Yep. Thank you.
Representative Lane, and then we're going to proceed with the presentation. Representative
Lane. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually just want to point out that I see 1 and 2 consist of $1 billion of the $2.7 billion, so that's really very large. It's the professional technical services and the roads and bridges. As one might expect, those two make up the larger proportion of the procurement system. And in that, wondering what professional technical services were, I realize that coming down a few slides up here, we'll get more information on that. So, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Allen, I know we have some other folks. Representative Anderson, quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a real quick question for Director Allen. And I just wanted to follow up on something that Representative Loon was addressing, and that was this advertising budget. We see all these billboards. All these different departments are doing advertisements. Is there a way that we can get a breakdown on which one of these departments, or all the different departments, and what they are advertising out there? Not the content, but just the finances.
Well, Mr. Allen, I think what you've been telling us is that we can go to the actual Open Checkbook website and see for us ourselves if we hit on that printing and advertising button. Will that take us directly to where it all goes, or?
Madam Chair, I hope it would be as easy as that, and I encourage you all to explore this and try to use the resource. In the meantime, I would be happy to try to do some of the digging ourselves, partly because it's a new tool, and we're still trying to figure out exactly what we can and can't get and how easy it is, and we'll do our best to get you the information on the advertising component.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Awesome. Okay, Mr. Allen.
If you move quickly to slide 5, you will see some information on just sort of the volume of contracting work that comes through our division. Gives you kind of a sense of what a lot of our day-to-day work focuses on. And one major element of what we do is develop these enterprise contracts, and those are contracts that can be used across state agencies, and as I mentioned earlier, can also be used by local units of government. And we have over 2,000 of those contracts, which means that an agency or a local unit doesn't have to sort of start from scratch every time they want to buy something, but can rely on a contract that's already been developed that offers good pricing because of the aggregated quantity of purchases that will be made from the contract. And then Betsy's shop, and she'll talk about this more in a little bit, actually reviews almost 4,000 professional technical documents a year. The purchasing that we do is done in partnership with the agencies. I've been talking for the most part about a central procurement office function. But we understood that a lot of what you're interested in is what we do versus what agencies do and what degree of oversight there is of what the agencies do. Looking at slide 6, you'll get kind of a preview of the concept of delegation. We delegate to individuals and agencies to do some of the lower dollar value purchasing of goods and services. In some specific instances, we have individuals who have delegations to sign professional technical contracts on behalf of the Commissioner of Administration. We also have delegations to agencies where they can sign contracts where the substance of the agreement doesn't change very much from one instance to another, and they're essentially signing standard language, and we're not where we don't think that admin would add a lot of value by reviewing each of those individually. If you move on to slide 7, you'll see that literally every agency in state government has employees who have delegated authority from the Commissioner of Administration. One thing that's probably important to note is that these aren't delegations to agencies. They're delegations to the specific individuals within the agencies, and it's individuals who have been trained and tested in order to receive the delegated authority from our agency. If you look at the slide, you'll see there are a number of different sort of dollar thresholds at which we allow people to purchase on behalf of administration. About 84% of the folks with delegated authority are at that $10,000 level. So that's far and away the most frequent level of delegation that's been awarded. A lot of this the system depends in large part on trusting the integrity and competence of these state employees. We do random audits of their work, but not all individuals are audited. Delegations can be and have been revoked when we become aware of any misuse. But again, much of this relies on training, testing, and trust. Many of the most complex contracts that the state is involved with involve the professional, technical, or intellectual services, and that's Betsy's area of expertise. We have a staff of 6 people, 5 of whom are attorneys, that are overseeing this area, and Betsy will tell you more about that.
Thank you, Kent. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll be covering the next set of slides that focus primarily on the professional technical contracting area. And professional technical contracting is quite a bit different in process than how commodities and general services are purchased. And the key distinction really with PT, we call them PT contracts, is that it's decentralized. There's a statute in Chapter 15, 15.061, that provides individual agencies with the contracting authority to do professional technical contracting. So these types of contracts are written in the agency's name. They're largely involved in developing the contract. They write the RFPs, the request for proposals that invite competition for these types of contracts. They do the evaluations of the proposals, and they select the contractors and draft the initial contracts. And really, if you think about why that's set up that way and why that statutory framework is engaged in, it's a model that's used throughout the country. It's because professional technical services are often more personal to the agency. These are the types of contracts where you'll have a consultant that's coming in and maybe doing strategic planning for the agency. They may be doing training. They may be consultants evaluating programs, things of that nature, where the agencies want to be in a lead role in selecting and controlling that particular contract. So that is a little bit, I think, of the underlying reason why these types of contracts tend to have a decentralized model to them throughout the country. Admin's role in these particular types of contracts is one of oversight. We have a staff in our professional technical contracts unit that consists of 5 people, including myself, 2 of which are attorneys who come into certain parts of the PT process and review the agency's work. This would be, for example, at the beginning of the process where a staff person in my office would receive the RFP that the agency's drafted and review the RFP, look for things, make sure that it meets the legal requirements, that it assures fair and open competition, and that it's in a proper form to be issued to the public. So the role of the attorneys really overseeing these contracts is really a balance between kind of a customer service role where we're working with the agencies and helping them and answering their questions and a balance between that and a real compliance and regulatory role where sometimes we have to say no to the agencies and reroute them or help them find a different direction. Also in our professional technical services unit, and I'm moving to slide number 9, we have a negotiations team that consists of 2 attorneys who work with the agencies at their request to assist with contract negotiations. And this is something that we started in 2007 and has been a big success. Really initially started in mind with cost savings objectives, but I think as the staff that have worked on this throughout the years, they really find the value in working with the vendors to develop the scope of work and to make sure that as you're developing a contract that you have a real mutual assent and meeting of the minds as you're entering into the contract, and that's so significant with respect to avoiding misunderstandings and having delays and cost overruns is and that's the piece that's been found to provide a significant value, even more so or as much as the cost savings that you can get through vigorous negotiations and contracts. Along with the oversight function for professional services contracts and the negotiation services, our unit provides a complement of training. We have courses, everything from drafting an effective RFP to procurement ethics. We train on contract drafting, amendment drafting. We train on contract enforcement. And we also do a series of negotiation-related training as far as fundamentals to crash courses in negotiation. Our negotiations team, one thing I forgot to mention is that they do work with agencies to resolve and work with mid-contract enforcement issues. So if an agency is experiencing a problem as a contract is going through its performance, we have attorneys that can come and help the agencies resolve those issues. As Kent mentioned, there is an amount of delegation that's done in various areas, and the professional services area is no exception. Slide number 10 addresses some of the agencies that have specific delegations. And again, I should say it's not to the agency, it's to individuals within the agencies. Again, agencies that have a proven track record and capacity and capability to take on these delegations. And so the 6 agencies that are listed have specific delegations. A lot of them are within certain dollar limits to sign particular contracts, but as Kent mentioned, some of the types of delegations are specific to a particular template. So if an agency is, for example, the Department of Natural Resources enters into hundreds and hundreds of contracts for their electronic licensing where certain retail entities can sell hunting licenses and so forth, and those contracts are all the same. So we don't add the value to reviewing those over and over again and delegate that to an individual within the DNR, as an example. I think there was a question, Madam Chair.
We have several questions. I wanted you to get through slide 10, and then we will break for some questions here.
Okay. So as I was saying, all of the delegations are limited in either dollars or by specific template or by, in the case of the Department of Commerce, for example, that entails their operation of the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program, where that that delegation is specific to their commissioner to operate that program. So the delegations are different and specific to individuals.
Okay. We've got Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going back to the local government access to some of these contracts. And I'm just wondering, so if a city is building a new city hall and you've contracted with a lighting contractor for how it should be done, I mean, is that basically something that's available to the city when it comes to building a building? So lighting contracting.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, I'd need to check to be sure I give you the correct answer to that specific question. Those are the types of contracts that are likely available, but let me check on industrial lighting as sort of the category you'd want more information on.
Representative Runbeck.
Madam Chair, yes, that would be Mr. Allen. I mean, I'm speaking from out of a conversation with such an individual who felt that you know, there's various ways to do it, and so sort of one method was the only way to go. But
Mr. Allen,
Madam Chair, if I could add, again, cities are never required to use any of these state contracts that we make available, so they might find it convenient, cost efficient to do that, but nothing would ever compel a city to say this is our only option.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Runbeck.
And Madam Chair, if I could, a follow-up, a different question, different subject. Recalling Best Buy and a phantom product that they were buying for years and totally millions of dollars. The product never existed, you know, in their purchasing. But, I mean, do you have a method by which you could discover if there are these phantom products and, you know, effectively massive fraud from a particular vendor?
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, I don't know about what Best Buy was experiencing.
Madam Chair, and my point is, I guess it happens. And so with the kinds of dollars you're talking about here, I mean, would there be a way to find out if this kind of thing is going on within state government?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, would it be a situation where, like, an individual state employee is directing public money to a business where they have they're colluding with someone in the business to...
Madam Chair, yes. Yes, that was it. And something totally fictional was created that was a business product, never existed. Invoices went out over the years, you know. So it does happen, apparently.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would hesitate to ever say something couldn't happen, but there are substantial checks and balances and delegation of duties and so forth in state agencies that I would believe would be sufficient to protect the state against that particular problem.
And Mr. Allen, does that fall under your guys' purview, or is that MMB, or who kind of monitors that, or is it by agency, and do we as a state have a standard of how we do that to protect against fraudulent purchases?
Madam Chair, much of the responsibility for that would be within the agency itself in terms of auditing and supervision and segregation of duties. The OLA looks at issues like that on and some of their work, and I certainly would get involved if a report was sent to the OLA of a perceived fraudulent activity of that nature.
Mr. Allen, though, does the Department of Administration provide guidance, though, to agencies of these are the protocols that you should follow in order to protect against something like that from happening? Or are you saying that each agency develops their own policies? And is there any check if there are policies in place for each agency at all?
Madam Chair, I think the OLA financial audits look at issues of segregation of duties that would get to that risk.
But there's no, so what you're saying is we as a state do not have a policy in place that gives guidelines to our agencies of here's what you need to guard against, here are the guidelines to guard against any fraudulent purchases.
Madam Chair, no, that wouldn't be what I would be intending to say. There are any number of state policies that address that. They'd primarily be MMB policies.
I think Mr. Shepard can help us out a little bit on this.
Madam Chair, members, this isn't specific to procurement, but there is a law on the books under the jurisdiction of MMB that requires them to have a system of internal controls across executive branch state agencies to safeguard public funds and access. And this is something the legislature mandated about 5 or 6 years ago, that and actually this committee passed legislation that beefed up that internal audit function. It's not specific to procurement of goods and services. It's more general.
But it rests under the responsibilities then of MMB, Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. So we should maybe, we'll follow up with them to see, you know, how often they track that for you, Ms. Representative Runbeck. I've got Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Allen, or maybe Ms. Hayes, in terms of bids and contracts, how do you work with targeted groups, minority groups, veterans-owned small businesses? How do you work with that? Is that an agency, or that's with the Department of Administration?
Mr. Allen or Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, we have programs that are specific to what are called targeted businesses, and those are businesses owned, small businesses in Minnesota, owned by women and minorities and individuals with disabilities. We have newer, similar programs for veteran-owned businesses. People here may be aware that one of the governor's budget initiatives this year is to put more resources into those programs. Currently, most of the available resource we have in that area is directed at certifying the businesses, and we'd like to do more outreach than we've been able to do. We'd like to be able to put more resource into certifying veteran-owned businesses. As we look forward, it's an area where we have programs now, but we would like to greatly expand the focus on those programs if the resources become available to do that.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And probably the resources would be, an FTE or somebody to manage that program. Is that what we were talking about?
Mr. Allen?
Correct, Madam Chair, Representative Detmer. We're looking for staff that could work on certifications of veterans, staff that could provide technical support and outreach to minority, female, disabled, and veteran-owned businesses. It's an area that's been under-resourced for a decade or more, and it's a governor's priority and something that we're looking forward to being able to do a better job with.
Thank you. Thank you.
I've got Representative Johnson, and then what we're going to do is I have a couple of questions, and then after that, then we're going to go through slide 17 before we go to questions that may come up. So if you have questions as the presentation goes, just write them down, and I'll make sure that we'll get you on the list. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would think that for any significant contract, there must be multiple persons involved with it, so it almost has to be an act of collusion or something to for a major fraud situation. Am I correct in that, or Mr. Allen?
Well, I think what Representative Runbeck is referring to, that I'm assuming it was an employee that set up a fake entity, and they were the purchaser, and they sent the money to the fake entity, and that's kind of the, how they did it. But Mr.
But I wasn't referring specifically, Madam Chair, to Representative Runbeck. I'm just in general.
Oh, okay. Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. There would be few instances in which one individual would be the only party involved in a contract award. Evaluations are usually done on a team basis. RFPs are reviewed by multiple parties. Individuals, in some instances, have to attest to the fact that they don't have any personal conflicts of interest. Businesses have to attest that they don't have any organizational conflicts of interest. I mean, there are some, you know, nothing's foolproof, but there are some substantial checks and balances in the process.
Thank you. One follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
You talked about the administration that delegates review and signature authority to certain individuals in agencies. Does that individual stay constant then among change in governors or whatever? I'm just trying to get a sense of it's how political it is. I mean, if it's independent, Republican, Democrat, does it make any difference, or is it not play that way?
Madam Chair, Representative, both Betsy and I are long-term civil servants who have, I've been involved in procurement going back to the Carlson administration, so I've served Republicans and Democrats and an independents governor. I report to the Commissioner of Administration, but one of the reasons why I think Minnesota has been more effective than some states is that we have civil servants running these programs who can provide some degree of insulation between the procurement process and any political process.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Hayes, I've got a couple of questions. You talked about the, you do periodic audits of the purchasers. How often does that happen? Is that once a year? Can you give me a time frame? Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Ms. Hayes is asking me to answer that one. There is no set timetable, and because we are dealing with over 600 people with delegated authority, and so some of them will never be audited. We always audit if issues are raised, so on an exception basis we would do an audit, and then we do some occasional audits that are based primarily on availability of staff time. So I wouldn't want you to think that it's a frequent or assured occurrence.
Mr. Allen, can you tell me then how many audits you perform in a year?
Madam Chair, I can't, but I'll try to get some better data on that for you.
Mr. Allen, do you have like a ballpark figure? Are we talking?
Madam Chair, I'd really be guessing. I'd rather get you a good number.
Sure. And why is it that some people would never be audited? And then are they aware that they're never going to be audited?
Madam Chair, no one would ever be given the assurance that they'll never be audited. So the prospect of an audit is one of the things that we would hope keeps people honest and above board. I'm sorry, was there a second part of your question?
No, that's fine. I do have a couple other questions, too. Ms. Hayes, you had talked about kind of the significant cost savings from having the two attorneys that you have helping out on negotiations. Do you know ballpark figure of how much that is? Or
Madam Chair, the we've been tracking negotiation savings for several years, leading back to about 2007. Our figures and our figures are based on looking at the amount of money, for example, that a contract started at and the savings that were achieved through the negotiation. But we've tracked about a little bit over $48 million in savings since that time with the negotiations that our two staff attorneys have been engaged in.
And have you tracked it, though, from the perspective of this is a common contract that you've had in the past and in comparison of the deals that you've been able to secure by doing maybe a better job in negotiations? Because as it sounds to me, you're just saying, well, this is the starting number that they gave to us and this is what we ended at. But are you doing it more of a comparison of prior to us being more diligent on negotiations, this is the savings that we've gotten? And do you have any numbers on that?
Madam Chair, you're correct that when you're trying to determine what the savings are from a professional technical services contract, it gets complicated because oftentimes the scope will change. So we have worked on different methods for tracking the cost estimates or the savings and cost avoidance estimates that have been leaning towards a fairly, what we think, a conservative estimate. And I can get you more detail on the various ways that we track, but there's a number of different ways that we try to calculate those savings.
Okay.
And I could follow up with you on the methods that we use. There's some different approaches.
Okay, that would be helpful. And then I had another question, too. Do the agencies themselves, some of them have their own attorneys that do their contracts for them, and then your attorneys work with them, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, yes. Many agencies have general counsels or attorneys who are working in their contracts area, and so we have gotten accustomed to working with many attorneys in many different agencies.
Okay. All right. I have some more questions just on the contracts themselves, but I think you'll come to that here in a little bit. So with that, members, we're going to proceed going through slide 17, and then we'll pause again for questions at that time.
Madam Chair, I believe I left off on slide, or I'm approaching slide 11. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the types of delegations that are provided with respect to professional services contracts. And one of the areas where admin has provided delegation is with respect to highway construction. MnDOT has extensive authority in Chapter 161 with respect to their highway construction procedures. This includes MnDOT utilizing various procurement methods, whether it be best value. They have construction manager general contractor authority, which is a newer delivery method. They use design build processes, and those types of activities are conducted within MnDOT, and they have delegation to do that from the Department of Administration. There are certain things that the Department of Administration still reviews and signs with respect to highway construction, and those include the design build contracts and any contract that stems from a single source acquisition where MnDOT has requested a single source. They do not have the delegated authority to address or to sign or approve those within their agency. The next set of slides I want to talk about initially more as a group. Slide 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16 talks about a different kind of situation where the Department of Administration is not conducting the type of oversight I talked about in the beginning, where we're reviewing documents on as they come in. These are situations where the legislature has provided a specific exemption for these entities, and I wanted to include the precise language of the delegation because there's some nuance to them, and so I'll go through them one by one, so I don't want you to feel like you have to try to read everything on the slide, but I think it's important that you have the language in front of you. With respect to MnSKU, there's been a fairly blanket exemption for MnSKU that's been in law for a long time. I believe it goes back to the mid-1990s where MnSKU fell out of admin oversight. The language exempting MnSKU provides that they're generally exempt unless the specific statute in 16C includes them. And there are some instances where MnSKU is included, for example, our design build construction authority, MNSCU, is included in that. Some other provisions, like they're subject to non-visual access standards, which address accessibility with our state procurements. Those are just a couple examples of where MNSCU is specifically included. The next slide, slide 13, addresses the lottery. The lottery is an agency with an exemption that notes specific types of contracts, and it references lottery procurement contracts as being exempt. And lottery procurement contracts are defined within the lottery statutes, and these are the types of contracts. They're lottery products, computer hardware, and software used to monitor sales of lottery tickets. So those types of contracts are exempt from the statute. There are certain types of contracts that, per the statute, are not exempt. And so the lottery, excuse me, procurement contracts that are exempt do not include contracts for materials, supplies, or equipment or services common to the operation of a state agency. So many of their contracts that are standard contracts that aren't specific to lottery procurement contracts do come through the Department of Administration. The particular contracts that are exempt do not receive any kind of signature from admin. They're not subject to the public notice provisions or the professional technical process or service general service provisions. The next agency that has a special exemption in law is the zoo. The zoo and then and MNSURE, which is on the next slide, have a common structure to them in the language of the statute, in which they start off with a general exemption from Chapter 16C, which is the procurement statutes, but then there's exceptions to that exemption. And in the case of the zoo, the exceptions to the overall exemption are fairly broad. They almost swallow up the exemption itself. So with respect to the Minnesota Zoo, we do review a lot of their contracts. We have, they go through our division for a lot of their products and general commodities contracts. They also submit all of their professional technical documents to admin for review. The one thing that we don't do with the zoo is we don't sign their contracts, but we do review the documents that lead up to the contract. And like I mentioned with MNSURE on slide 15, they also have an overall exemption, but then it's listed a lot of exceptions to that exemption. So they still are subject to some of the provisions of 16C. For example, 16C.086 is something they're still subject to. That pertains to limitations on contracting out call centers and things of that nature. They also are required to adhere to certain provisions of 16C that we call the certification requirements. They have to certify that there aren't state employees able and available, that they are not allowing work to start on contracts before a contract is signed, that there will be knowledge transfer of their professional services contracts, that they will have the termination language in, that they are subject to the retainage requirements, and those types of things. So there's some exceptions to their overall exemption. MNSURE is also required in the law to have consulted with the Commissioner of Administration in the implementation of their own procurement policies, which they did a few years ago prior to their exercising their exemption. The next slide covers another contracting exemption, which is the IRRRB. They have a unique exemption where they're given a choice in their law whether they can choose to follow the municipal contracting law procedures, or they can follow the procedures of the procurement procedures of Chapter 16C. That was a exemption that was passed not too many years ago. So in addition to those contracts that we delegate out, in addition to the contracts that have a legal exemption, there are also some specific statutory exemptions for certain types of purchases, and that list is on slide 17, and that includes, for example, purchases from MinCor, certain types of commodities and items for resale that are provided by certain programs that agencies run, and then there's some unique type of things like DNR's purchases for fighting fires has a statutory exemption, along with public safety's purchase of state and federal disaster assistance related contracts.
Okay, Ms. Hayes, I'm going to pause you there. I've got Representative Howe that has some questions. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, Ms. Hayes, Mike, I got a couple of questions. One of them pertains to the lottery, and did that exception, and I guess in your opinion, did that exception that they have there, or would have been normal practice? I'm trying to gauge how to actually ask the question, because with the electronic pull tab, when they chose that vendor and they kind of based their estimates on that vendor, and that's kind of what got us into this debacle, is that if they wouldn't have had that exemption, would we have maybe had different vendors in play and seen maybe a different estimate on the numbers? I know that's all subjective, but I'm just wondering if there would have been a different contract, if they wouldn't have had the exemption, if we would have had more play in that contract decision and maybe a better outcome.
Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, it's really difficult to, especially since I haven't seen those particular contracts, that they did not come through the department, for me to be able to judge whether or not we would have had a different result. A lot of times, the context of the situation places the contracting people in scenarios where you're having to choose the better of not so great options. So it would be impossible really for me to tell you what differences might have happened absent the exemption. So I really can't say more than that.
Representative Howe.
Thank you. And my next question actually comes to, could you, I know you explained it a little bit, but when it comes to MinSure and their exemptions, I understand that you had some of their contracts or some of their processes do come through your office. So could you explain what role you do play with them, and then maybe expound if they had less exemptions or if you had more role in it, if there's what would you do different today if you had the chance to do that MinSure piece over again?
Ms. Hayes.
To avoid the debacles that we had.
Ms. Hayes.
Madam Chair, Representative, MinSure's exemption extends to areas where they choose not to use our general procurement system. So we have, for example, a lot of programs and things that MinSure can opt in to use, and when they do decide to opt in, they follow our standard procurement rules, and that covers a lot of their of the IT services that they're doing now. I know they use, for example, the ASAP IT master contract program extensively. They use the SITE, which is another master contract program for IT services, quite extensively. I think, again, with respect to if we had it to do over again, I can't play kind of Monday morning quarterback and try to guess what would have happened had we been involved more in some of those situations. I think that it's something where every time we see an agency seeking exemptions of these nature of this type of nature, we would like to see the consistency and the stability of central oversight, I think, is helpful. But there's also unique situations where agencies need to have more flexibility. I think MinSure was under a unique set of circumstances with time and so forth that they felt they needed to have different processes and more expedited ability to procure the goods and services.
And Representative Howe.
Thank you. To that point, did you feel that, well, and I guess I look at it, it seemed like it took them a quite a long time to get those contracts in place. I would have thought that if you had those standard IT packages already there, that that would have been a much quicker way to do it than going out for a new contract with... I would have thought that if you got a standard package already in place, wouldn't that be a quicker way to get those IT packages in place rather than going out and writing new stuff?
Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair, Representative, for the staff augmentation type of projects where you're hiring an individual one at a time to do, for example, project management or technical analysis or business analyst type services, it is a lot quicker to use a master contract program, and that's one of the reasons we set them up is because it's a streamlined process. And Minsure does use those programs extensively. I think a lot of the other contracts that might be at issue are the larger systems projects where it's a project that you wouldn't necessarily procure through the master contract programs. Those are often more short-term one individual coming in to do staff augmentation, so they wouldn't be using those types of master programs often for these larger contracts.
Okay. Representative Howe? Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, on slide 16, and just kind of referring back to line 15, your just earlier comments about consistency and a desire to have a general function of oversight, you know, with these various agencies, I'm struck by some of the inconsistencies because as it would pertain to the IRRRB, I see that they are exempt from 16A, 16B, 16C, but as it would pertain to 16C.086, it doesn't preclude them from being adherent to that section, which would regard to call centers. So are you aware of any oversight that you are processing to that issue?
Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair, member, I don't know that there's been an instance that I recall where that issue's come up with IRRRB and the use of call centers. I know that to the extent that they're availing themselves of the provisions of 16C, that would, like I said, with the IRRRB, they have the option in a procurement process to choose whether to go through the municipal contracting law process or utilize Chapter 16C. And in instances where they're utilizing Chapter 16C, 16C.086 would kick in and they'd have to adhere to it. And I'm not aware of any situations where that's been an issue.
Well, Ms. Hayes, I don't know if you know this or Mr. Shepherd knows the answer to this. You had mentioned, I think, earlier that this was a recent exemption provided to the IRRRB. Do you know when did this come into play? Mr. Shepherd, do you know?
Madam Chair and members, I think it was in 2013, but I will look it up in just a minute and let you know for sure.
Sounds good. Representative Albright, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm and just to follow on to that, I see in your slide number 15 that Minsure is not exempt from 16C.086, but yet I'm again struck by the contrast with the next slide where they are exempt with the prevailing that they are given the choice. I'm just wondering from a consistency or continuity standpoint, is there a number of agencies that negotiate their own exemptions, or how does this happen?
Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair and Representative, I think as you can see, the examples that we have in statute have developed over the course of a long period of time, and they are very nuanced and unique, and they happen one agency at a time, and the agencies bring forward language that they feel addresses the particular situation that they're addressing at the time. So there isn't a standard language, set of language or exemption language that's utilized. They happen sort of on a case by case, one at a time, and they're very different and nuanced. And I thought that was and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have the individual sets of language in front of you to see that they're not all the same, and they're not blanket exemptions either. There's just a lot of nuance to each one independently.
Okay, we've got Representative Carlson and Representative Earhart. I have a couple questions, and then we're going to go to the rest of the slides after that. So, yeah. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think it was Commissioner Allen that made the comment about Minsky and the changes in the mid-1990s. And I have two questions. We called it the Mandate Reduction Bill, and we worked, it was a legislative initiative, but we worked closely with the Carlson administration at the time to reduce the number of mandates. And my first question is on the state stores or the procurement side, how has that worked? What we wanted to do was give them the choice of using local vendors if they could get the best buy versus going through admin. And I'm just curious what your reaction to that is. How well has it worked? Do they still use the state stores for purchasing? Or are they going mainly through local vendors when they purchase materials and supplies for the college campuses? And then I have another unrelated question.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think Minsky might have a different perspective on how this works than I do. Minsky, during my term of service in this role, has been sort of the equivalent of a local unit of government in terms of their flexibility to use our contracts if they choose or not use our contracts. I think they historically have blended use of some state contracts with some local purchasing, and I certainly understand their interest in being able to buy in the community, and that's an important element of purchasing for an institution that needs to have a community presence. A few years ago, the central Minsky offices were taking more of a consolidated approach again, and I think that was something that saw some resistance at the campus level. Again, because I think there are issues of campus autonomy and local purchasing, and I after seeing that pretty strong push a few years ago to have more Minsky-wide contracts, and seeing that that wasn't really a hit at the campus level, I'm really not sure where they are today on issues of procurement, but they have the choice of using our contracts or not, and I think that works well for them.
Madam Chair, that's essentially what I was trying to find out, your last comment, how well it seemed to be working. So you're saying, at least in their view, it's working well. You know, it's like many legislative things. I'm not sure there was a whole lot of follow-up once that was passed in terms of how well it was working. It was somewhat, Madam Chair, controversial at the time as to whether they would be required to continue to use, I don't know if you still use the term state stores, that's what we used back then, or not. My second question, Madam Chair, deals with Minsky as well, and it's without getting into the pros and cons of a given contract, looking at the history, but there was a contract that was led administratively by Minsky for a couple million dollars. And historically, would a contract like that have been reviewed, and that was for consulting services, would that have historically been reviewed by admin? The internal controversy was that it never went to the board. And I'm just curious, with your role here today, if prior to the various exemptions for Minsky, if a contract of that size would have gone to admin, whether it went to their board or not.
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, if we had PT, professional technical contract oversight of Minsky, equivalent to what we have of other state agencies, we would have had to review and approve that contract.
Okay, Madam Chair, just to clarify, I was trying to figure out prior to the the 1990s changes, prior to that mandate reduction bill that went through, would you have had that review under the either the old state university system, or that was the early days of Minsky? So would you have had that review historically?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair and Representative, I believe so. I mean, that precedes my time in the role that I'm in, so I can't say with absolute certainty what we were doing then, but certainly if we were reviewing Minsky today the way we review other state agencies, that would have been...
I think that answers the question, at least today, where things would be, but thank you.
Okay. Representative Earhart.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Two items. I think that for those out in TV land that Representative Runbeck was referring to a fraud in a private company and had nothing to do with a state agency. Am I correct?
I believe that it is. She referred to Best Buy, yes. Representative Earhart.
Well, it was a little hazy, I thought. So just so that we haven't found any fraud in any of the agencies so far. And then is there any connection with the agencies that have these exemptions? Minsky, Lottery already been talked about. We have the Minnesota Zoo, which has some problems. Minsure, which you've already talked about, and RRRB has also got some problems. That the fact that they have certain exemptions here that are causing, maybe starting to cause these problems because they have exemptions?
Ms. Hayes?
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, I don't know personally of any direct, that where I could say that, you know, had there been, admin, had at the absence of this exemption would definitely have avoided the various issues that have come up lately. It would only be speculation as to whether or not any of those would have been avoided, and so it's very difficult to make that direct tie with these exemptions.
Representative Earhart?
No, I was just curious because those that have exemptions have been in the news lately with various problems, and I just was wondering if there's any connection.
I think, Representative Earhart, you raise an excellent point, and that is, you know, one of the reasons that I asked that you guys come here today and specifically talk to about the exemption piece. I have concerns about how we handle this. I think just even overall how we handle our contracts. Lottery was one of the ones that kind of piqued my interest to begin with. We've had legislation that has gone through the legislature here that puts in question the contracts that were signed and what kind of liability it puts the state at. You know, I've had different attorneys, nonpartisan people, look at those contracts and say, I can't tell if the state is on the hook or not on the hook. Others that say the state is on the hook, others that say that the state isn't on the hook. And I think that's problematic as an entity overall, in that we need to make sure that we have contracts in place that protect the state and hold us harmless from any liability going forward. So I think this has been very instructive. I appreciate you guys coming and kind of giving us an idea of how you guys operate and maybe how we can help to make it better for the state moving forward, as Representative Earhart has outlined. I do have two more people left on the list. I've got questions. I'm going to hold off my questions because we still have to get to number 26 of your slides, and we have 10 to go, essentially. So Representative Pugh, then Representative Howe, then we're just going to go through all the rest of the slides, and hopefully we'll have time left to ask any additional questions that members have. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a very, very short ask. I would greatly appreciate knowing which state agencies have a general counsel or an attorney on board who is negotiating these contracts, which may the answer to that question just at some point in the future might help us understand why these contracts are so difficult for the public to really understand to what degree we, you know, they're just, it's very confusing. So, thank you.
And Representative Howe.
Thank you. And I just would like you to confirm for me is do the agencies with these agencies with these exceptions still, their information still goes into that database, that new database, and we can still drill down and look at that data. Is that not correct?
Ms. Hayes or Mr. Allen? Or
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, their data is still entered into the SWIFT system.
And Representative Howe?
Apart from MNSCU, I don't believe, is that data in? I'd have to check with MNSCU to be sure. I'm not.
I don't think it is.
I don't, yeah, I don't think MNSCU data is, but I'd have to check.
Representative Howe?
That would be great to know because I believe that they all should be reviewed and in there so we can drill down at those that data. But that would be great information to have. Thank you.
And just, but do you actually get the physical contracts themselves too?
Madam Chair, are you referring to the MNSCU?
No, I'm referring to like the IRRRB, the lottery. Do you get a copy of the contracts that they sign, even though that they're exempted?
Madam Chair, we do not get physical copies of the contracts through the exemption. However, I do receive copies of anything that's signed under delegated authority. I do ask for copies of those and check those periodically from the, for example, on page or slide number 10, those entities that are signing. We do see those contracts, but not contracts from the exempt entities.
Okay. And then when there's a problem with a contract that's being revoked, do you step up kind of your review efforts?
Madam Chair, I think if there's been a problem that we're aware of, that and we actually track issues with not just contracts, but RFPs that we notice. We track the types of issues that we see as we do our reviews with contracts so that we can target our training so that if we see, for example, issues with amendment drafting or problems there that are occurring more often in a particular agency, we can work with them directly to try to deal with that. So we are shifting our review strategy based on problems that come up and are identified.
All right, Ms. Hayes, if you can go through the rest of the slides, and then hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for any other questions that members have.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members, we left off on slide number 18, and that's the last slide that I have until I'll turn this back over to Kent. But the last slide that I'll talk about deals with standardized templates, and that's something that's very important. The state has standard templates for just about every type of contract and contracting documents, whether standard RFP templates that are used. I believe these templates are used whether an agency is exempt. They often use our templates or through delegated authority, and these really help promote consistency in the use of good language. There's terms in these templates that have withstanded the test of time that have been in contracts, as far as I know, for 30-plus years. And these clauses and so forth in templates have been developed in conjunction with the Attorney General's office. So the use of these templates are important and helpful. It's something that the government's known for being good at making forms, and I think we're pretty good at our contract templates. And so the standard types of language that you'll see in a lot of contracts, we have termination, liability, data practice, intellectual property, those types of contract clauses. Agencies who are using the templates, don't have to reinvent the wheel. That is not to say that every contract has that identical term every time. Those types of things are sometimes need to be negotiated, but the agencies have access through our standards templates a starting point for those types of difficult clauses. In addition, state law in Chapter 16, it's 16C05, it requires the Attorney General's Office to come in and periodically review our contracts and evaluate samples of state agency contracts. And that review, the most recent one occurred this past January, where the Attorney General came in and found no substantive issues. They looked at samples of PT contracts, building construction contracts. They looked at commodities, leases, those types of things. So, and they were really looking from the standpoint of the standard template usage and making sure that we were including the clauses that the law requires us to and not including certain things that the law prohibits us from having. So that audit occurred just recently.
I'm going to try to move through the next slide pretty rapidly because I know the time is limited here. If you look at slide 19, it sort of lays out a primary reason why a considerable amount of oversight may be appropriate in public sector procurement. And it's making the point that public sector procurement is very different than in the private sector, where there's generally broad discretion to select providers of goods and services, whereas in the public sector, we really have to ensure that all interested vendors have an opportunity, that the process is transparent, and so forth. We're also balancing a lot of competing interests in the public sector, and I'll say a little bit more about that. In fact, slide 20 begins to point out how we're not just going for the best value for taxpayers' dollars. Obviously, that's a priority, but it has to be weighed in the context of some of the fair and open competition issues, some ethical standards that are applied, and probably most importantly, a goodly number of legislative and executive priorities that have been added to the procurement process. And I'll say a little bit more about that on an upcoming slide. Slide 21 is really just giving you a flavor of how prescriptive it can be to have fair and open competition in public procurement. It involves equal access to all, advance public notice, selection criteria that are clear and stated in advance, making sure that interested vendors all get the same information at the same point in time, doing a selection based on a legal process that's been clarified in advance of the solicitations. Some of the things that get us, or get hopefully not us, but can get folks in trouble with public procurement are shown on slide 22. There's always the potential for conflicts of interest at the level of a state employee who's participating in the process. Anything that could compromise their integrity is a potential issue. Additionally, organizations can have conflicts of interest. If a business has done prior work with a state agency, it may give them an unfair competitive advantage. There could be other instances in which a business could be disqualified for having a conflict of interest. And then just another element of public procurement is the fact that it needs to be an open and transparent process. Ultimately, public procurement records become public information in most instances, and we have to be able to document and defend how decisions were made based on public documents. When we make any errors in any of this process, or when a vendor believes we've made errors, they have recourse of various sorts. They can protest public procurement decisions. There are audits by our organization and the OLA, follow-ups on any alleged improprieties, and ultimately unhappy vendors can take pretty much any of our decisions to a judicial forum for a resolution there. There's a quote from Alan Page of the Minnesota Supreme Court on page 23 that just points out the fact that courts take a very close look at the procurement decisions made by public officials with an eye for the realization that there can be fraud and favoritism and so forth. So again, what we do has to be very carefully documented and defensible. If you look at slide 24, it's giving you kind of a laundry list of some of the legislative objectives that we deal with in the process. These all have good intentions behind them, obviously, but also do add some complexity to the process. Representative Detmer mentioned the programs we have for women, minority, disabled people, veterans. I'm not going to go through all of these, but lots of preferences that tie to environmental, environmentally preferable purchasing. Two changes that were made just last year got added to this list. One is the human rights equal pay requirement. There's now a certification process for businesses seeking contracts over $500,000. They apply to the Human Rights Department and attest to the fact that there is no gender-based discrimination in their business, and that step is now a requirement before we can sign contracts for over $500,000. And the last one on the list is also a new requirement that was passed last year. It's called the Responsible Contractor Act. It deals strictly with construction vendors. And when we're awarding contracts over $50,000 in the construction environment, we must state a number of requirements for the vendor in the solicitation that relate to issues such as their payment of prevailing wage, their success in working with targeted vendors, and so forth. And vendors can be disqualified from participating if they fail to meet that statutorily created standard for a responsible construction vendor. Those are just some samples. And then the next few slides simply talk about some of the evolution of how the procurement laws have changed. 1998, we kind of went from low bid to a best value approach. 2007, we started looking at procurement from much more of an enterprise approach with more product standardization and aggregated demand. 2013-14, some modifications that to some degree I've already described. Slide 28 gives you some additional resources, tells you how to contact me and Betsy. The one resource listed there, interestingly, the Pew Center on the States did an objective or third-party study of some states that have been effective in their procurement programs, and they focused on Minnesota and Virginia. And so that's a good sort of third-party assessment of how we're doing that gives you a lot more background on Minnesota procurement.
That's great. We have 1 minute. Any questions before we adjourn? Thank you so much. If we have questions, if we have questions, we'll be sure to contact you, and I know that you'll be getting us some more materials. This has been great. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. With that, members, we are adjourned.